Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is brought to you today by PetMate Plastic Dog Crates, trusted providers of safety and comfort for your dog. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And today, I'm actually super excited to bring you this excerpt. It's from a presentation by Dr. Paige Pierce. She's a veterinary behaviorist, and it was sponsored by the Clumber Spaniel Health Foundation at the 2018 Clumber Spaniel Club of America National Specialty. Dr. Pierce is addressing the topic of increasing focus in performance dogs, especially those that are overly social, as they say. I hope you enjoy this presentation. A lot of great information in here.
We're very happy to have Dr. Paige Pierce, who is an animal behaviorist, who's going to come talk about our overly social dogs. And every single one of us could probably bring a dog down to demonstrate that right now. Walking from here to the conference center, they're accosting every other visitor in the hotel. So it's a good problem to have, but we would like to know maybe how to channel that into positive ways. So please welcome Dr. Pierce.
That introduction, and thanks for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here to talk with you guys about increasing focus in performance dogs in general, and in particular in dogs who love people and love visiting with people. This is where we start. I understand that the potential exists with Clumber Spaniels to leave a performance task and go visit with somebody. When I look at this concern, I think about it as wanting to know why. Why is that happening? Before I can figure out what I want to do about it, I want to know why it's happening. The medical person in me, the behavior stuff is the same as the medical stuff. Trying to find a diagnosis before we know the best way to treatment is the desired path. So when I look at this, I see two why questions there. One is the leaving the task, and the second is the visiting the person, visiting a friend, visiting a stranger, visiting a ring steward. Why is that happening? Seems like it should be a no-brainer, but it could be helpful to take a little closer look. So why would a dog do that? Because it's enjoyable. There's attention, there's social interaction. Those are very reinforcing things. In addition, it takes very little effort to go visit a person. And there is a long, strong reinforcement history of getting to this reward. We like it when our puppies go visit people. We like it when they're sweet and friendly to strangers. Those are all good things. There's nothing bad about that. It just tells us what we're up against when we're trying to outcompete this competing motivation. So with that, let's look at the other half of the issue. Dog chooses to leave task. Why would that happen? This is the audience participation portion of the show. So why would you think, what are reasons why a dog might leave a task that he's engaged in or step away from his handler?
He's not interested in what he is doing.
Stress.
Yeah.
It's a difficult task.
Absolutely.
He saw something more interesting.
Yes.
Or someone has food.
Yeah. Right. Always. I love all of those answers. And I think they fit into these three categories. Medical causes, training lapses, and emotional factors. I heard stress. And I think if we visit all of those possibilities and rule out the possibility of medical causes, rule out the possibilities of training and emotional factors, then we can look at what are the management strategies, what are the training strategies to impact that behavior. I don't want my wording choice to be distracting, so I'm using performance to mean the immediacy of response, the correctness of response, precision, speed and enthusiasm when those are called for, the ability to stay in a long down when that's called for. And I honestly only know the most superficial things about hunt tests and tracking, so I don't know exactly what those performance goals are, but I'm trying to use that word broadly to encompass all of those factors. And then the focus and impulse control, using those to optimize performance, and thinking about decreased performance as visiting and any other sub-optical execution of a performance task. So it's no surprise that if a dog is uncomfortable or has a physical impairment, that his task is going to be harder. And when that happens, it's easy to default to a well-rehearsed, easy-to-perform, internally reinforcing behavior. Medical aspects, we always think of pain first. Other aspects that we should consider, there are lots of diseases that cause decreased energy. There are lots of diseases that cause nausea prior to vomiting or weight loss, and those would impact a dog's interest in training, especially training for food. We can't quiz our dogs about whether they feel irritable or fuzzy-headed, but we know from people who have low thyroid and diabetes that those are part of their symptomology, and we certainly expect we see those things in our dogs as well. Decreased vision can happen with cataracts, retinal changes, and episodic things like hypertension, and of course any sensory changes, so hearing changes as well. When I see an adult dog who all of a sudden changes his behavior, I always think about medical stuff first. Because of the different patterns of how we can see the impact of medical causes, because it can be gradual over time, because it can be episodic with normalcy in between, it really does always warrant checking things out with an exam, possibly additional diagnostics. And then looking at emotional factors for decreased performance, what we know is that the thinking part of the brain can essentially disengage. When emotions are high, it's a teeter-totter, a constant teeter-totter. If a dog is being cognitive, we can kind of tamp down emotions. If a dog is very emotional, and people too, of course, if we're experiencing very emotional things, then our ability for cognition is lower. When a dog isn't sure exactly what's being asked of him, or if his emotions are hijacking his cognitive abilities, then that makes it tempting to leave the task as well. Examples of arousal, something like a dog who loves his treats and you go to the fridge to get out the liver brownies and the dog who is just so excited spinning circles to get those liver brownies, who literally cannot hear you, cannot comprehend or comply with what you're asking of him just because he's so excited about those brownies. That's emotion, arousal, swamping cognitive abilities. A less happy example of that would be the tourist in a big city being mugged in a dark alley at gunpoint. Even if that tourist is an engineer or an accountant, the answer to a math problem is not going to be forthcoming in that moment. So what happens when our dogs don't know the answer to the problem or can't access that thinking part of the brain? They might freeze or fidget or perform the task incorrectly, or they might just ditch the task entirely and go off to do an easy behavior that makes them feel good. So I group training lapses and anxiety and arousal together because I feel like they cause similar symptomology. Sometimes we get obvious body language. The dog, he's up, he's alert, he's vigilant, he's looking all around. You can see that's an aroused dog. Other dogs, obvious fear, anxiety, crouching, tucking in, more white of the eye, maybe trembling, maybe stress panting. What we think of as tension relieving behaviors, also called calming signals. These are signals that dogs give when they are feeling internally stressed or if they feel like there's tension around them. They yawn, they air lick or lip lick, they scratch. I would add sneezing to this list, sniffing. Sometimes sniffing the ground is sniffing the ground. Sometimes sniffing the ground is stress. Shaking off, you've all seen that. Dogs who aren't wet do that big whole body shake. That can be a tension relieving action. When we don't get so lucky as to have obvious body language to guide us that our dog is experiencing one of these things, we can sometimes ask the question, when does visiting occur? Does it occur the first run of the first day of the trial? And that might indicate a dog who's so aroused, so happy about being at that event with his favorite person that he just can't think straight. Or does the visiting or lesser performance happen on Sunday afternoon during the last event? And certainly then we think about mental fatigue, physical fatigue. Impulse control itself is a finite commodity. We can use up impulse control, and that might be something that occurs by the end of a trial weekend. If a dog is slower to perform, or if you're seeing incorrect performances, off courses that don't occur in a class setting, any of those types of things, then I'd be suspicious that we would need to rule one of these things out. Think of the dogs that get tagged with descriptors like stubborn or blowing off their handler, ring savvy. Very often we've got some sort of anxiety or arousal or some training issue that we thought was on board, but the dog learned something slightly different than what we intended to train. Mm-hmm. So we'll look at each of these individually. When I think about training, and I use the word lapses here, even though I don't really like this word, I could come up with a better one. Training disconnect, training miscommunication. I'm not sure what to call it, but just having in mind how contextual dogs are with their learning. Having a well-learned behavior in one environment doesn't necessarily transfer easily to the next environment. Verbal commands, we're so used to using words, and our dogs are so good at reading our body language that sometimes it looks like they know what we've said, like they've truly connected that verbal to the task, but sometimes they haven't, and it's hard to recognize that until something else happens, until we move it to a different environment or something else changes. Kind of the flip side of that is a start line state in agility. We see this a lot. I'm sure you recognize this, you've seen this before, where the dog is set at the start line, the handler walks away, the handler intends to cue a verbal release, and the dog is looking at the whole handler. And so we often use our bodies so ritually in those situations that there's something in our bodies that precedes getting out the verbal that the dog is able to recognize. So the dog releases on the body language, and until something shifts to make it obvious, it looks like, everything happens so quickly, it looks like the dog's releasing on the verbal, but really it is the body language. So we can have those disconnects that aren't always recognized early on. And certainly any skill, if it's not built through all of those additional changes, won't hold up well when those changes happen. New locations, new distractions, if there's a new handler. And for just consideration, that I'm sure you guys have been thinking about this for the past year as you're planning to truck your dogs out here to Oregon, that the mental and physical conditioning has to be there as well. So for some dogs, these triggers that exist in a trial, in a performance environment, are triggers for anxiety. For other dogs, they might just be causing a little bit of uncertainty, and there are those dogs that are completely unfazed. The unintended feedback, what I wanted to convey with that was the times when we're directing our dog through an activity and we make a mistake and we do that, I meant to do, and that moment of just sighing or a quick grunt, many dogs will not realize that that isn't directed toward them. So we can actually accidentally deflate our dog's enthusiasm or decrease their confidence by accidentally providing that feedback, that unintended feedback. Another scenario that I think is fairly common is when dogs move from a class setting to a performance setting and the rate of reinforcement is not as high. The potential for that dog to become a little concerned about why has the change happened, oh, I'm not getting the feedback that I used to get, may or may not be evident at that event. But the next event, the dog may have made the calculation that, well, that really didn't provide the paycheck that I'm used to getting, not quite as motivated to have the same level of focus, possibly competing motivators then are able to sneak in. Arousal is emotionality that is often not under the dog's control. So any base emotion, happy, excitement, fear, can tumble into arousal. A little bit of arousal for a performance dog, we usually like that. That can get a more up, a more sparkly performance, possibly more speed and enthusiasm on an agility course. But unchecked emotionality tends to get in the way of focus and precision. Anticipation can be the anticipation of something fun happening. Frustration can be about not being able to get to that fun thing fast enough. Have you ever seen a leashed dog who barks and lunges at the end of his leash? Pretty common behavior, typically triggered by frustration at wanting to greet and being restricted just by the distance of the leash. That frustration can climb into this arousal that even the most well-trained dog no longer has the ability to hear a request for sit or a request for come. It's that teeter-totter where arousal just swamps cognitive abilities and the dog is no longer able to hear, comprehend, comply. And I think it's worth noting the difference between drive and arousal. We think about drive as a internal self-directed desire to perform operant behaviors in a given context with predictable consequences. And that's something that's very much under the dog's emotional control versus arousal being something that spins out of control that the dog doesn't really have an ability to get a handle on easily. So we want to assess for all of those possibilities, make sure we've ruled out the medical causes, the training and emotional factors, and then we can move into how do we address these dogs that are super social? What can we do to help out that circumstance? I put management strategies first because it's a whole lot easier to address something in the moment about the environment than it is to train a different response to the environment. Even a dog who's really bright and is going to pick up a new behavior very quickly, it takes months to train that new behavior, to build enough foundation with that new behavior that it is going to be successful in multiple contexts, especially with increasing levels of distraction. So when I think about using the environment, when I think about management strategies, I think about how to use the environment to benefit your individual dog. And then in particular, in those 2 to 10 minutes prior to entering the ring, how can the environment be utilized to your advantage? Antecedents are everything that comes before the behavior that influences the behavior. Consequences are everything that come after the behavior that influence the behavior. So we're really good as trainers thinking about consequences. We do this all the time. We bring out the food that we know our dog likes. We can get really creative. I was in an agility class with a border terrier handler who literally kept a mouse house at home so that she could get those shavings and droppings and put them in a single-use plastic water bottle, and that was her dog's tug toy at the end of the run. The tugging itself and the smell from the mice were very, very meaningful to him. The other side of the equation, certainly we think about the cue as the antecedent, but we often give less thought to the other potential antecedent, to what else is there that can impact behavior to our favor. So in this picture, if it's a rainy day and this grass is wet, it might be hard to teach this dog down. It might be hard for him to quickly perform a down behavior. So grass would be an antecedent. If his tongue is hanging out because he just did 20 reps of fetch it, he might be too tired to have the crisp responses to cues. Or maybe after 20 reps of fetch it, he finally has the edge taken off and he can pay attention and respond. So thinking about how to harness all of those things that come before can improve performance in multiple ways. This is another example to illustrate this point further. Picture 2 different scenarios for a reading task. First grader sitting at his desk at school, learning to read, versus this kid's got his adoring BFF. He's got his teddy bear there in the background. He's in his blanket fort with his cool lantern and his spacesuit helmet. So he's got this cool frontier spaceman vibe thing going on. And who's going to learn to love reading more? Who's going to be less distractible when something happens? I totally stole this example from a woman named Sarah Owings, who used to be a kindergarten teacher until she became a full-time dog trainer. And she's also a lecturer with Clicker Expo. So if you ever get a chance to see Sarah Owings talk, don't pass it up. She's really awesome. This could be called managing the environment. This could be called setting the stage. Location, style of crating, that could matter to certain dogs. It could be that a dog who sits in the X-Pen in the middle of the throng of people is using up impulse control by watching people walk by and not being able to interact with them. That dog might do better in the covered crate in the car. Conversely, the dog who's in the covered crate might then walk into the performance venue and just be overwhelmed by all the people, and that's not helpful for that individual. So grading where your dog is with each of these items that we can control. We can control these parts of the environment, these parts of the pre-performance behavior. I think about, you know, from the morning arriving at the performance venue up until the time you walk into the ring, all these things can be used to your dog's advantage. There are some dogs that will benefit with being very engaged with the handler full time. There are other dogs that will do better being allowed to do some sniffing and some exploring. And same with people. There may actually be scenarios where a dog who loves people can kind of diffuse that need, satisfy that need by being able to mob a friend. And maybe that timing is 5 minutes before his performance, maybe it's an hour before. All those things are variables that we can think about and utilize to advantage. Training history is kind of a longer take on antecedents, but certainly impacts any performance. And relationship, I'm sure you all have heard this phrase, I don't know to whom to attribute it originally, but the comment about the only thing that we get to bring into the ring with us is our relationship with our dogs. I love that phrase, and I would add to it, the only thing we bring into the ring with us is our relationship with the dog and the mental state that we've built in on the way to the ring. So antecedents are all about getting your dog geared to be in the best possible frame of mind for performance. So if we manage the day and then have a choreographed, rehearsed, pre-ring routine, whatever we know is going to be best for our dog in that 5 minutes prior to entering the ring, then that gives additional predictability, which adds confidence. And it's something that you have much more control of. If we think about that as part of the performance, that's something that we actually have more control of than when we enter the ring.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, Laura at puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details.
So I've got one section left on training strategies themselves. Are there any questions at this point?
Could you kind of expand a bit on that drive versus arousal? I'm thinking more along the lines like of the fast cat racing, where the dogs are highly aroused, but they're also engaging their prey, and one works together for that performance versus this drive versus arousal.
Yeah. So I haven't picked apart that type of sport, and I apologize, did you say lure coursing or is it something else?
Lure coursing or fast cat, it's just 100 yards.
Okay. Yeah, so I would anticipate that that involves both drive and arousal. And would arousal be detrimental in that scenario? I don't know. If the setup is such that there are no options for the dog except to stay in that course until they get to the target, then an excess of arousal might not be detrimental, except prior to going in and after coming off.
Yeah. And that's kind of what you see a lot, is they will kind of bleed off a lot of that drive with this extreme behavior before they get to run. So that's that pre-ring routine would be very valuable then, so they don't spend so much energy in that aroused state, perhaps. But I just found that interesting.
It's an interesting thought. Yeah, and I apologize, I don't have familiarity with that. I haven't thought about it, but I like what you're saying. I like the idea of trying to find the best level of arousal for that individual for that sport.
I was going to say, at a hunt test, we call it just in time to the line. So you are the next dog on the course. You don't know exactly how long they'll take, but you know how long your dog can actually comfortably sit there without falling apart. So it's like, I will be there when I need to be there, but don't make me come up 15 minutes early,
right?
Because I'm going to lose everything I have. So, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And that just in time to line. Often, I think the case with many, many dogs, they either can't stand the pressure of the other dogs, especially with agility, where you've got border collies staring at all the other dogs. Yep. And I can say that about border collies, because I have and love border collies. But they have that stare, and it's not a comfortable thing to be the object of that stare. So that's another great example of trying to find what is the sequence that works best to have your dog at that best frame of mind when you get there. I'm fortunate enough, I have a little Pomeranian mix-ish type dog, and he is super food motivated. If I get to the ring and I'm a couple minutes early, I have the luxury. I can actually sit and like look at a couple of the runs before me and tell my dog to go sniff. And he disengages from me. He's happy as a clam to just go. It's obnoxious, right? I hate that behavior. But for him, it works. It takes him from, do you have cheese, Mom? Do you have cheese? What are we doing? And if he does that for 2 minutes, I don't have enough energy left when he gets to the ring. He doesn't have enough energy left when we get to the ring. But I can just kind of take him down a notch by letting him sniff. But who would have guessed? But it works great for him. And then when it's time for, when we're on the line, then he's able to snap back and focus, and then he's got some energy to run. So it really just does take some exploration, and sometimes surprising things are successful. So this is where it gets really fun. I'm a list maker and an organizer. So these four categories are just kind of fabrications. I just tried to think of everything, every training concept that would impact how do we increase focus, how do we increase impulse control, and then plug them into these categories. It's not sequential. Nothing is contingent upon anything else. And since I was invited to talk about people as distractions, we're going to start with changing the significance of this distraction. So one way to do this is to create a new behavior, to think of a behavior that is mutually exclusive from mobbing a person to visit. And it ends up using the person as a prop rather than an emotional outlet. So we shift the dog from thinking, oh, person equals excitement, desire to visit, to person equals I'm waiting for a cue to interact the way you taught me to interact with that prop. A nose touch to hand is a nice way to do this. That's a middle early stage of training. It starts with the hand right near the dog's nose, so the dog's inclined to investigate, and then we can capture that behavior and reward it, and then get increasingly distant from the dog to come to the target of the hand, and then transfer that behavior to another person's hand. And as soon as the behavior is completed, the dog's expectation is, I have performed this operant task. Okay, Mom, where's the reward? So the whole potential concern of overexcitement with greeting becomes out of the picture because we're stacking that teeter-totter. We're leveraging the operant behavior in order to make the emotional behavior tamped down. So that's the first skill. A different behavior with the person. The second skill is to put visiting on cue, which does nothing in and of itself to change the dog's visiting, even if it's not cue, but it allows us to harness this fantastic reward. If a dog loves visiting, we can use visiting to reinforce other behaviors. This is actually a psychological principle called the Premack principle. Leslie McDevitt does a great job explaining this principle in her books, Control Unleashed. She talks about having her dog come in order to chase squirrels. So the principle states, the wording is something like, a highly probable behavior can be used to reinforce a less probable behavior. So if come is not a strong behavior, but we make it easy for the dog, call from right here, come, and then go chase squirrels, or go visit people, then the joy of the chasing and the visiting actually makes the come behavior or the eye contact behavior, whatever we've requested, much, much stronger. So that's a neat way to take what would have been an annoyance, a distraction, and actually utilize it to make the behaviors you want stronger. The third skill is desensitizing and counter-conditioning in the same way that we help people overcome fear of spiders, the same way we help dogs overcome fear of riding in cars. Some dogs are scared of fireworks. I'm guessing your breed doesn't have a lot of concern about loud concussive noises. The ability to change the expectation, change what that item means, riding in the car, the fireworks, the person. My colleague calls this open bar, closed bar. It just looks like I'm with my dog, a person appears, food, food, food. Person's gone, closed bar. Person appears, open bar, food, food, food. Person's gone, food stops. It's classical counter conditioning. It's Pavlov. It gives the dogs a different response to the person. The person ends up meaning something different to the dog. So those repetitions do need to start with the person far enough away that the draw to the person doesn't overwhelm the draw to the food. But it can then be worked closer and closer to the person. And because the foundation gets put in place, then the food does outcompete the person. And the neat thing about that is that it can shift then. It's not just that you've got food for the dog. It's that then the dog sees a person and he's looking to you like, okay, every other time this meant really good food. Now you've got the dog's attention. So now you've got something to work with and you can advance then to whatever other skills you want to sandwich in there. So the whole second category, the second category of training strategies, these are global skills. If focus and impulse control were muscles, these would be the skills that would strengthen those muscles. These are separate from the performance tasks. These are separate from people. These are just ways for the dog to practice how to maintain impulse control, maintain cognitive ability in the face of higher arousal. So go wild and freeze. I should say every trainer has their own take on these. There's lots of different ways to do them. There's no wrong way to do any of these things. And they have different names too. So go wild and freeze is sometimes go wild and sit. I've seen it called play and pause. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's getting your dog really revved up with your voice, with your body, lots of animation. And then when he's really happy and jumping around and you're playing together, still your body, ask for a sit. And can your dog do that? The very early stages, we don't build up too much excitement in the dog because we want him to be successful. We want him to be able to sit as soon as the engagement shifts. And then we can either reward with a piece of food, or if your dog just loves that style of play, then just jump right back into, let's play, you know, get them all animated again, and then ask for a different behavior. It's just toggling back and forth between arousal and cognition. Teaching the dogs how to maintain access to their thinking brains and over multiple training reps in gradually increasing amounts of arousal.
My thanks to Dr. Pierce and the Klumber Spaniel Health Foundation for providing access to this excellent information. Really outstanding. And you can learn more about the foundation and other nonprofits benefiting our dogs in episode number 179. Of Pure Dog Talk. You can also check out today's blog post for contact information for Dr. Pierce. Thanks for joining us. Pet Mate's tip of the week is keep your dog safe in your home and your home safe from your dog by crate training your puppy so he's happy, comfortably snoozing away while you run errands, pick up the kids from school, or even enjoy a date night. It's bad enough to come home to garbage strewn all over the house. But if your dog eats the wrong thing, his mayhem can turn deadly really fast. Check out Petmate's Plastic Kennels, a safe and secure home for your dog. Just click the link at www.puredogtalk.com/partners and use promo code PUREDOG for special savings only for you guys, Pure Dog Talk listeners. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Supers desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.